Hey everybody, join us as we delve into our favorite dark tales and paranormal mysteries.
Venture with us beyond the safe places that exist in daylight as we go
beyond the shadows. True crime,
paranormal,
hauntings,
UFOs,
cryptids and unsolved mysteries,
conspiracy theories,
past lives,
reincarnation,
and all the like are just a few of the topics that we will tackle.
If it haunts your fucking dreams, then it will be on our show.
Shadows where you find me at. You can't see me in the deepest blacks. When your heart start racing and you see the cracks, all these creepy things that you might attract. All the demons be where the action's at. So listen up if you want it. UFOs, all them ghosts, we got everything that you want. Whoa.
Do you know what the most frightening thing in the world is?
Hey everyone, welcome back to Beyond the Shadows, episode 73.
Welcome back, Shadow Contingent.
He's scraping the bottom, folks.
No, not even. I got at least three more weeks worth of shit.
They're only going to get worse.
Oh, they're definitely going to get worse.
Way worse each time.
So before we get started, we definitely want to say thank you, everybody, for coming out in full force this week. Our numbers have been through the roof. By far our best week ever. So
yeah, absolutely. We really appreciate it. Thanks for sharing it with your family. Keep doing it. We're growing nicely, and it's all because of you guys.
Very grateful, everybody. Thank you.
Yeah, really. So I wanted to give a little update because you guys know we did the couple cases on Sean Diddy Combs. Well, was it yesterday? They raided his house. Two days ago. They went ahead and raided his house. See, I told you.
House is.
Yeah, you should have been listening to me.
They got him in Miami and L.A.
Yep.
L.A.,
yep. And so what happened, basically, you guys know that Cassie filed that lawsuit against him, and that pretty much opened up everything. And there was a bunch of other lawsuits that came in. And there was another one by Joy Dickerson. She dropped a lawsuit claiming that that Diddy had videotaped her and when she was being sexually assaulted by a couple of his crew, and he also sexually assaulted her. She was a student at Syracuse University. But there was another case that I had missed. This was in February. Maybe it wasn't out yet. But there was a Rodney Jones, also known as Little Rod. He filed a lawsuit against Diddy and several others accusing them of sexually assaulting him.
Seems like this is the one that got things moving.
Yeah, you know, Cassie was the one that put it out there, so I think the FBI became aware. There's a lot of different conspiracies. They think that she maybe had a cell phone that belonged to his former I'm going to mess up the name. But anyways,
just mumble it.
Yeah.
That's
what I always do anyways. But anyways,
Do the Elvis when you know.
But there in the lawsuit by Rodney Jones, there was several other celebrities mentioned, including Jennifer Lopez, Prince Harry, and Cuba Gooding Jr.
He's just name dropping on Prince Harry. He's got nothing.
Well, there wasn't much on Harry, just mostly that he was at the the event.
It was a name drop to bring in the
To bring people in. But Cuba Gooding, he claims that he was making advances at him that were unwanted sexual advances.
He's actually been accused of a couple
things. It's his second time, so yeah. So that one was new for me. I didn't catch that.
50 Cent has gotten a kick out of this whole thing.
Oh my God, he loves it.
He hates Diddy, hates him. So his tweet was, Diddy done. Diddy done.
He's ruthless, man. He's definitely ruthless. But there's another gentleman in that lawsuit. His name was Brendan Paul, and he was arrested. And this guy is said to be Diddy's mule. This guy supposedly supplies him with all his drugs and guns and actually prostitutes and stuff like that. So this guy was just arrested. He was arrested trying to leave on Diddy's private plane.
That's the one they called his mule, right?
Yeah. So there's been things about, they said that Diddy was at the airport and this and that. I don't think they really know where he's at. He's around somewhere, but he has no charges against him yet. They've just raided his homes and stuff.
They're coming
for sure. So there's a lot of stuff out there, and we'll keep watching.
When they bring in Homeland Security and force like they did like that, there's charges coming for shit, sure. And there better be.
But there's so much stuff on this guy.
He's, He's a scum fuck. Let's face it.
Yeah, I did. I did two episodes on him. I could have done another two. I left out so much stuff because you just can't fit it all
in. He's such a dirtbag. If he dodges this, then it just proves that anybody with money can dodge anything.
Yeah,
period.
Absolutely.
The whole world knows he's a dirtbag. The proof is out there. Take him down or, you know.
Yep. So anyways, what do we got in the news this week? Let's lighten it up a bit.
I got some weird shit as usual. So this first story is really weird, even by our standards. So a guy in Wasco, California was arrested on Friday, not too long after a man was hit by a train at the town's Amtrak station. Now, the reason the guy was arrested? Because eyewitnesses saw him strolling through town carrying a human leg and gnawing on it like a chicken bone.
Taking some bites out of it.
Yes.
When I hear this dude, all I can think of is like Fred Flintstone with a big fucking pterodactyl.
Yeah, and that's what I picture. And it's crazy that the world's come to that.
Go ahead.
Rosendo Talese was arrested on Friday for one misdemeanor charge. Misdemeanor. Of removal of human remains from other than a cemetery. So to me, apparently, if he dug up that leg from a grave and gnawed on it rather than grabbing it from the site, that would have been okay.
I guess he got hit by a train. It wasn't a crime scene, so it's not removing anything from a crime scene or anything like that. There's probably not a charge for it. You know, I mean, is there a law in the books that you can't pick up a leg and gnaw on it?
Well, no, apparently there is.
Specifically?
So there is video of Talese biting on what appears to be a human leg, as well as waving it around for police. He's reported to be a local homeless man. But for me, it just amazes me that walking up on an active crime scene and just making off with a body part is only a misdemeanor.
Yeah, no doubt.
As well as eating it. But
yeah, that's so twisted.
See, that's a weird one.
Yeah, I don't know.
So I think that one is still ongoing. We don't have any more. It happened. He hasn't gone to trial, obviously, or anything like that. So also in the news, a woman in Knutsford, England, recently found a baby hedgehog wounded on the pavement, and she brought it home to nurse it back to health. The little bundle hadn't recovered by morning, and it hadn't eaten any of the food she'd brought it.
Nothing either. She give it did no. anything.
Nothing she did any good whatsoever, nope. Which is sad.
Yeah, it is sad. So she took it in and brought it to the professionals.
She did. She brought it to the wildlife hospital to have a professional look at it. And the hospital manager, Janet Coetzee, had to deliver the bad news that the animal did not make it. Because it wasn't an animal at all.
It was a fucking pom-pom.
Or a bauble, as they say in England.
A bauble.
It was a piece of a fucking hat.
It was a top. We call them pom-poms here, but the top of a winter cap.
It's a bauble there.
So yeah.
How embarrassing is that?
She tried feeding it?
The fuck? She did. She tried feeding it? But the good news that the story doesn't mention is that both the mittens were able to pull through.
Yeah. All right, Ryan, so what do you got for us this week?
In the dark forest lies a secret, told in broken stories by those who bore witness, a monster, a murder, a long-forgotten homestead. I'm on the search for the ghosts who haunt these places, and I want you to come along. Welcome to Tales, Trails, and Taverns. Here I take an active approach to finding places that people might warn you not to go to. Haunted trails, abandoned towns, old taverns where you might catch a glimpse of a long-deceased patron. Look, you're probably not going to find me trekking through Arizona looking to have a run-in with a skinwalker, and you certainly won't catch me playing with a Ouija board, but I have spent at least the last 10 years seeking out creepy, haunted, and abandoned places to explore. So lace up your boots, grab a working flashlight, and join me as I tell the tales, hike the trails, and grab a cold pint at the local tavern. You can find the podcast on Apple, iHeartRadio, and Spotify. You can find show updates on Instagram, TikTok, Threads, Facebook, and YouTube. And also check out the blog at TalesTrailsAndTaverns.com. And now, I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
So we're going to do a sequel to The Vanished
Oh, yeah. I like that one.
Series that I did a while ago.
Yeah, that did good. People seemed to like that one.
It did. And there's so many cases. When I was doing the research for that first one, I came up with so many cases. All of a sudden, I was like, man, I'm going to do like 3-4 more. So,
all right.
And there's going to be more to come after this. So we're going to call this one Vanished Again.
All right. Sounds good.
I spent a lot of time on that.
Yeah, so. Really put something into that title.
That's it. That's all I got. Just the title. All right. We'll be right back, guys. So for our first vanishing, we go back to the 1700s in England. Owen Parfitt lived in Shelton Mallet in southwest England after a colorful life. He had served in the military and was stationed in Africa. He would regale anyone willing to listen to the stories of his battlefield heroics. He described himself as fearless, having won many a day and saved his fellow soldiers. He would also tell everyone about the great many women he'd been able to take to bed. But he wasn't finished there, as he also claimed to have been a pirate as well. He wasn't known as a particularly kind man, and he wasn't overly well-liked. By 1768, he had reached the age of 69 and was no longer able to live on his own. One thing Owen's family had was longevity. At a time when the average life expectancy was 37, his father had lived to an age of 62, and his mother had reached 97.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
What year is this?
1768. So this is before the American Revolution.
Wow.
He was now forced to stay with his 80-year-old sister Mary, so she's old too, as he was now paralyzed from the waist down. Mary's neighbor and friend, Susanna Snook, would come over and help out with Owen. In the mornings, Mary and Susanna would move Owen from his bed into a chair. If the weather was nice out, they would place him in his favorite wicker chair out on the porch. On the morning of June 6th, 1768, the day started out cool, and Owen was forced to stay inside. When the afternoon began to warm up, the ladies wrapped him in his favorite heavy old coat and brought him outside to his spot in the sun. His sister went back into the house to do some chores, but she was never more than 20 feet away or so. She chatted back and forth with him the entire time, but at one point, he didn't answer a question she had asked, so she went to the door to look. What she found shocked her. His chair was empty, and his blanket lay on the ground. Owen was not able to walk in the slightest, so he certainly hadn't moved on his own. None of the neighbors had seen him move either, but he couldn't be found anywhere. The mystery was never solved, and Owen Parfitt was never seen again.
Wow. You know, that's not exactly true, because when I was pulling pictures for this one, I found Owen. He's got a LinkedIn, and I grabbed the wrong pictures, and I put them in the stuff for the social media.
I'm glad I caught that.
Yeah, right. It's like, who's the guy in the helmet? Well, that's Owen.
He had a guy.
No, that's not him.
He had a guy in the bottom right, like a work helmet, like a construction guy helmet. That's not him.
Yeah, it is. That's just a different one. So my bad.
But that's crazy. So you got the 1700s. The guy can't walk. All the neighbors know them. None of them would have taken him. He didn't move off the porch on his own. Nobody saw him move. So I mean, he didn't walk away. And who the hell is going to kidnap a 70-year-old man? And what's the purpose?
What for?
Didn't find his body. So in a blink of an eye, he disappeared off the porch, but nobody knows where he went or why. I mean, he was a dick in his younger years. That seems universal. But did somebody hold a grudge for 50 years, where they just... That's what I mean.
He was in his 70s. No one he knew at that age was alive anymore.
Nobody who wronged in his younger days...
They're gone.
...came back.
Oh, so they were 70-something, too.
And what's your
or older.
What's your purpose in snatching an old man running down the street? But nobody saw that happen either. But even if they had missed it, what was the purpose?
Where was this?
England.
I'm trying to think if it was like an animal could have taken him or something, but shit.
I missed the page. I moved the page. He was in England. Fuck.
Yeah.
Douchebag.
Take that.
I'm searching.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm
searching.
That's crazy. He just gone.
So nobody knows where he is. That's mystery number one. Up next, we have Barbara Follett. So Barbara Newhall Follett was born on March 14th, 1914, in Hanover, New Hampshire. Her parents were both well-educated and worked in the literary field. Her dad was an editor, a literary critic, and a university lecturer. Her mom was a published children's author. Her younger sister, Sabra, would go on years later to be the first woman admitted as a graduate student to Princeton University. So clearly, this family is well accomplished and intelligent. And that runs in the New England blood for sure.
Oh, yeah.
I've got some of that. I
skipped my generation.
I was walking before I was six. I'm kind of a big deal.
You are kind of a big deal.
So when she was only 7 years old, Barbara began writing poems, primarily dealing with nature and wilderness. When she was eight, she began writing a book on an old typewriter, intended as a birthday present for her mother. Originally titled The Adventures of Eepersip, it was eventually renamed The House Without Windows. The story focused on a girl named Eepersip who runs away from home and her family to live instead in nature surrounded by animal friends. When her book was complete, it was entirely lost in a house fire, and she was forced to rewrite the entire thing. When she was done, and with the help of her editor father, her book was published by Knopf and received great critical acclaim. Both the New York Times and Saturday Review hailed her book as being amazing, and she was sought out for radio interviews and was asked to read and edit other children's novels. She was regarded by many at this point to be a child genius. Now, a veteran writer of the ripe old age of nine, Barbara published her second novel a year later. It was titled The Voyage of the Normandy, and it was based on her experiences on a coastal schooner in Nova Scotia. When she was 14 years old, her father abandoned her mother for another woman, devastating the whole family and hitting Barbara particularly hard. She was daddy's girl, and she did not take it well. She wrote, and these are her words, "My dreams are going through their death flurries. They are dying before the steel javelins and arrows of a world of time and money." Now, most kids like me would have just written, "My dad is a cock."
Right. I mean, so, see, this is, she's a little dramatic.
But she's got some talent.
Yeah, for sure.
So despite her young age, she had already reached the high point of her career. She ended up working as a secretary at the age of 16 to help keep her family afloat during the dark days of the Great Depression. In the summer of 1931, at the age of 17, Barbara met a man named Nickerson Rogers. They spent part of the following summer hiking the Appalachian Trail, then sailed to Spain, where they did more hiking through the Alps. She decided not to finish her high school degree and was at this point unemployed. They were married in 1934 and settled in Brookline, Massachusetts. She continued to write all through this period, but publishers no longer seemed interested in her work. Initially, her marriage was a happy one. She enjoyed taking dance classes and made hiking trips out west during the summers. When she returned from one such trip in 1939, she became convinced her husband was having an affair. She had been becoming increasingly unhappy with her married life in the months leading up to this point, and expressed as much in letters to family and friends. But this latest betrayal hit her every bit as hard as being abandoned by her father years before. She wrote a friend, "There is someone else. I had it coming to me, I know." She continued to become more and more depressed and could eventually only sleep with the help of medication. She later wrote, "On the surface, things are terribly, terribly calm and wrong. I still think there is a chance that the outcome will be a happy one. But I would have to think that anyway in order to live. So you can draw any conclusions from that you like." Or anything, any conclusions you like from that, excuse me. On the night of December 7th, 1939, Barbara and her husband had a fight, and she stormed out of the apartment with $30 in her pocket, or about $665 in today's money. So it's a decent amount.
Damn, that's a nice chunk of change.
She was never seen again. The only word we have on what happened that night comes from her husband, who didn't even bother to report her missing for 2 weeks. According to Nickerson Rogers, her husband, he waited to make the report because he thought she would soon return. A full 4 months after her disappearance, Nickerson requested a missing persons bulletin be issued.
But 4 months later?
So he reported her missing about a week later, but the missing persons bulletin he requested was 4 months later. So when it was issued, it went out with her married name, Barbara Rogers, which drew little attention. But had they used the name she achieved her fame with, Barbara Follett, it likely would have created a much bigger buzz with the press,
right,
and had drawn many more leads. Nobody knew who Barbara Rogers was in the press. This is 1939.
Hi, I'm Katie.
And I'm Kelly.
And if you're looking for a super fun, awesome podcast to listen to, check us out.
All things outrageously dark, scary, beautiful, and totally true.
Yeah, it's not like they're on TV or anything like nowadays.
No, yeah. So
social media.
She had been a big name as Barbara Follett years before, but nobody knew who Barbara Rogers was. The press didn't pick it up. It didn't create a buzz, and she wasn't found. So little was found during the investigation. Barbara's mother was disturbed by how little effort her husband put forth to find her daughter, and she implored the Brookline PD to look further into it, as many as 14 years later. In 1966, a book named Barbara was published. A collection of her writings and her life and disappearance were again brought to the public eye. Nothing of her was ever found, and police were never able to either include nor exclude foul play in her disappearance.
That's what it sounds like to me. It sounds like your husband disappeared her.
Probably. That's what I would lean to towards, too.
I mean, if you're a true crime person, it's usually the husband.
So we got one little last paragraph, which does shed a little light on this, maybe in her own words. So perhaps a clue to her fate could be found in the final words of her first book years before. At the end of The House Without Windows, the lonely Ypresip finally vanishes forever into the woods. Now she wrote, this is Barbara Follett, she would be invisible forever to all mortals, save those few who have minds to believe, eyes to see. To these, she is ever present, the spirit of nature, a sprite of the meadow, a naiad of lakes, a nymph of the woods, .. And perhaps that is what Barbara Follett is to this day. So her desire, at least in book form,
was to disappear
into nature.
And become part of nature, yes. Basically.
Is that what she did? Who knows? But she expressed in her own words that desire when she was a kid.
That's interesting.
November 23rd, 1953, near the U.S.-Canada border, U.S. Air Defense picks up a blip on the radar that should not be there. An unidentified object was moving through restricted airspace over Lake Superior, near Soho Locks, which was the area's most vital commercial gateway. The object was picked up on radar by operators at Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. Now, if I fuck that up, Michigan, give it to me.
give it to him.
I think I got it, but if I didn't, let me know. An F-89C Scorpion was scrambled from Kinross Air Fair Base, piloted by 27-year-old First Lieutenant Felix Monclaw, with Second Lieutenant Robert L. Wilson acting as the Scorpion's radar operator. Monclaw was a very experienced pilot with 811 hours of flying time, 121 of those coming in this or a very similar aircraft. Once they were airborne, Wilson was having a very difficult time tracking the object because it came changing directions and shifting altitude. Ground control helped them stay on the mystery object at speeds of over 500 miles per hour for over 30 minutes. The jet dropped from 25,000 feet down to 7,000 feet in pursuit of the craft. The jet was about 70 miles off a Keweenaw Point in Upper Michigan when they caught up with the mystery object. Ground control witnessed the two radar blips get closer until they merged into a single blip. It was assumed that Montclaw had flown either under or over the mystery object, and when he emerged on the other side, there would be two distinct blips again. That never happened. The mystery object continued on its original course. Soon afterwards, that blip also disappeared from radar.
Ooh, now, that's a weird one.
Very. Now, ground control attempted to contact the Scorpion by radio, but was unsuccessful. Now, both the USAF and the Royal Canadian Air Force sent out search parties, but no sign of the plane or the pilots was ever found. The initial reports more or less told the story exactly as it happened. But as is the case with the U.S. government, they quickly changed course and their story. They now said that ground control was misreading their radar, that the Scorpion had successfully completed their mission and intercepted the UFO, which was identified as Dakota, a Royal Canadian Air Force C-47 aircraft flying some 30 miles off course. Montclaw had likely been struck with vertigo. Now, I have no idea how they arrived at this conclusion, which led him to crash into Lake Michigan and sink to the bottom. The RAF emphatically denied this series of events and states that they had no aircraft in this region at that time. But that would mean our government had lied, which I do not believe for a second. Our government, the U.S. government does not lie.
Come on.
Bullshit.
You know, a lot of planes went down back then. I mean, we've done a bunch of stories where the planes have gone missing or whatever. But
yeah, during
with this, there's two distinct craft on the radar. One flies down to the other, and then it just disappears.
Yeah, so the two blips become one blip, and then no blips.
Yeah, so I mean, if it hit something, you would have seen, you know, I mean, if it ran into it, you'd see two blips again as they go into the ocean or whatever.
There's no crash. No crash scene. No debris.
Yeah, don't they say there's usually
the Canadians
like
say they weren't there, and I believe them. They weren't there. There's just the American government making
sure. Covering it up,
It wasn't a Canadian plane. They weren't there. It was a UFO, for sure. Now, what happened to the American plane, I don't know. Unsurprisingly, there is no record of any such incident in the Air Force files that even remotely resemble the encounter described here in that region or during that time period. Now, theories on this incident abound. Some mundane, like the plane crashed into the lake, which I don't believe for a second, but possible. But others hold that the plane exploded when it hit the UFO's force field barrier, like some Star Wars shit, which is plausible, I guess. You know?
It's Independence Day shit.
Who knows, man? I don't know how those things
You know,
work.
You think about it. Nowadays, I really, like we said, we look at them like possibly interdimensional. What if it's getting ready to jump from one to the next and the plane just happens to go through?
Maybe the portal was open.
Yeah, and they opened up so it could jump through, and this plane happened to come right down and suck through with it.
I believe all of that shit's possible. I'm not going to get into it, but I believe some of that shit's possible. The plane didn't crash in Lake Michigan. I don't believe that for a second. So the last theory is that the plane itself was pulled inside the UFO and the men were abducted, which is, again, in my mind, plausible. It's like a Death Star. I believe that shit's possible. They just opened up a portal, pulled it in. So in 2006, a man named Adam Jimenez of the Great Lakes Dive Company came forward and communicated with UFO bloggers and the interested online community that his company had discovered the wreckage in the lake of not only the plane, but pieces of the UFO as well. It wasn't long before it was determined that there was no such thing as the Great Lakes Dive Company. And Jimenez then disappeared as quickly as the Scorpion did in 1953. So it's just another, looks like another wrinkle to that story, you know.
That's an interesting one.
Variant. So Joan Bard was born on August 4th, 1930 in Brooklyn, New York. Her parents died in a mysterious fire when she was only 9. She went to live with her aunt and uncle, who later adopted her, making her name Joan Natris. In 1952, she graduated from Wilson College in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, with a degree in English literature. She took a job working for Crowell Collier Publishing. She later took a job with Thomas Y. Crowell Company, where she met and in 1956 married Martin Riesch. Not long after marrying, she left her job so that they could start a family. They lived in Ridgefield, Connecticut, where in 1959, their first child, a girl named Lillian, was born. The next year, she gave birth to a son they named David. In April 1961, the family moved to Lincoln, Massachusetts. Martin was working in an executive role for the Fitchburg Paper Company. The family seemed to be a happy one, and they settled in well with their new community. On Tuesday, October 21st, 1961, Martin left the house early in the morning to catch a flight out of Logan Airport bound for New York City. He planned on being away overnight and said that Joan was still asleep when he left the house. She woke later and went about a usual day, making breakfast for the kids. She had to take Lillian to a dentist appointment and dropped off David with a friend and neighbor, Barbara Barker. She drove off in her blue 1951 Chevrolet to the dentist appointment in nearby Bedford. She stopped in a few stores on the way home. And by Barbara Barker's account, she returned at about 10:55 and came to get David. She then left for home to make lunch for the kids. The milkman and the mailman both went by the house later in the morning and reported nothing was amiss. A dry cleaner stopped by to pick up some of Martin's suits at about 11:15 and also reported nothing amiss. Joan and the kids were just fine. At about noon, she is said to have put David down for his afternoon nap, which usually lasted until about 2. At about 1 p.m., neighbor Barbara brought over her son Douglas to play with Lillian in the Riesch backyard. When Douglas came home, he told his mother that while they had played in the yard, Joan had been cutting the grass. Barbara said that not too much later, Lillian had showed up at her house saying she had permission from her mother to come over and play. In Barbara's own words, quote, "I saw Joan at about 2:30. I saw her run beside her car. She had a trench coat on at the time. I saw something red. I thought she was chasing a child, and the child was wearing a red jacket. She was running with her arms outstretched. Later, I saw her walking towards the house." Fuck.
Matter.
Pages sucked again.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that she ran to the car. She went back to the house again. I did see something red. This was at about 2:15 p.m. Barbara brought Lillian back to her own house before going out to run some errands of her own. She did not actually see Joan when she dropped Lillian at home, however. She returned home about a half hour later and said that Lillian came over to her house and said, "I can't find Mommy. David is in bed and the place is messed up." When Barbara went into the house, Joan was nowhere to be found, and David was crying in his crib. The kitchen was covered in blood, and she quickly phoned the police. The call to the police was placed at 4:33 p.m., and Sergeant Mike McHugh arrived about 5 minutes later. He found blood all over the floor and the walls of the kitchen. The phone had been ripped out of the wall and was thrown into the trash can. The table and chairs had all been flipped over as well. His initial assumption was that she had committed suicide, but there was no weapon to be found, and there was also no body. He made sure that all area hospitals were on the lookout for someone matching her description. The blood trail from the kitchen appeared to go to David's crib and then back again to the kitchen. From there, it appeared to go to the driveway and then up to Joan's car. There were bloody palm prints and fingerprints, but Joan's prints were not on file, so there was nothing to match them.
So they don't know if they were hers or somebody else's.
Yeah, so on the car, there were bloody palm prints and fingerprints, but Joan's prints were not on file, so they were basically useless.
I wonder if they could tell, though, if it was a man or a woman. A woman's got a lot smaller hand than a
Good question.
Than a guy does, you know?
It's a good question. It's not included. I don't know. All told, there appeared to be about a pint of blood on the scene. A decent amount, but not enough to indicate a life-threatening injury. Someone appeared to have attempted to clean the scene using paper towels as well as David, the little boy's, overall. Overall, police found the blood evidence very perplexing. Despite the amount of blood, there were no bloody footprints. Someone appeared to have been very careful about where they stepped. They couldn't even determine where the bleeding had started and which direction it had moved. Besides the mess in the kitchen, there were drops in the master bedroom, on the stairs, near the window of the kid's bedroom, on the fender of the car, and then again in the middle of the trunk. The blood type was found to be type O, which is not only the most common type, but Jones type as well. DNA obviously was not available at the time, so we have no way of knowing if this was actually Jones' blood or just a similar type. So Martin, her husband, was called in Manhattan, and he caught the next flight home. He was able to tell police that the liquor bottle that they had found in their kitchen trash can had been consumed by he and his wife the night before, but he had no explanation for who drank the beer bottles that were also in the trash can or where they had come from. A local telephone book was open to the emergency numbers section, but none of those numbers had actually been called. There was a wire hanger found on the roof of Jones' car and had blood on it. Jones' trench coat and purse were both still found inside of the house. Now, police launched a large search by air and land, but no sign of Jones could be found. Virginia Keene reported that on the day of the disappearance, when she got off the school bus and walked towards her house, there was an unfamiliar two-tone dirty car parked in the Reese driveway. Another neighbor said that at about the exact same time, he had to stop for a car that was backing out of either the Keene or the Reese driveway. The Keene stated that there was no such car in their driveway that day, making it likely that the car was leaving the Reese residence. The police dismissed these sightings as a mistaken identity, however, saying that it was likely that an undercover police car was the one that they were reporting.
Why would that be there? Why would there be an undercover cop car?
And they were saying that the witnesses just fucked up the time. So they're saying the witnesses were wrong.
Oh, they're saying they're identifying basically their car.
Yeah, the police are full of shit. The girl getting off the bus knows what time she got off the bus and what she's reporting. So the police are later saying that their time frame is fucked up. It was a police car they were reporting.
This is a confusing fucking case.
It's a very confusing case.
So there's blood everywhere. There's a coat hanger. She's chasing after a car, her own car, right? Isn't that what they said? And or a car like her own. And then she's chasing something red. This is confusing.
Very confusing.
I haven't been saying anything, but trying to concentrate on all the details because you told me it was confusing.
We ain't even halfway there yet.
Right, keep going.
If you think you're confused now.
Buckle up.
So the police dismissed these sightings as mistaken identity, saying it was likely an undercover police car that had been reported, that the witnesses simply had the timeline wrong. In canvassing the neighborhood, police turned up at least three witnesses who saw a woman roughly fitting Jones' description walking down the side of the road somewhere between 2:45 and 4:15. In all reports, she appeared to be disheveled, disoriented, and quite possibly injured. Yet none of these witnesses called it in, nor attempted to help her in any way. Police and newspapers offered a cash reward for information that could help close the case, but nothing useful came in. In a strange twist, Serene Gerson, a reporter from Lincoln Fence Viewer newspaper, went to the town library to research any similar cases for background on this story. When she looked at a book about the disappearance of Brigham Young's 27th wife, she saw that Joan had checked out the book about a month before her disappearance. The book Into This Air was about a woman similar to Joan who had left behind blood and towels when she disappeared. And Joan had checked that one out as well. All told, she had taken out 25 books in recent months that all had to do with murders and disappearances. Her husband said that she was just fascinated with true crime. But some have speculated that she had actually been studying and planning her exit. The month after her disappearance, the Reach home received about a dozen phone calls. And when Joan's father-in-law answered, there was no one on the other end. Apparently, one of the neighbors received a phone call that same day from an agitated woman who said she had been phoning home all day but did not know the person answering the phone. Lots of explanations have come forward for Joan's disappearance over the years, that she staged her own disappearance to escape an unsatisfying life.
Towards the end, that's what it sounded like sure.
It does. That she had gone through an illegal and poorly performed abortion that left her bleeding.
I ain't going to lie. That's what I was thinking the whole time.
The coat hanger on the roof of the car.
That's exactly what I've been thinking the whole time. I didn't want to say it.
No, you go say anything you want. Now that's where we're at. We're at that point.
I was thinking that, and I'm like, man,
the coat
I don't know.
Hanger on the top of the car leads me to that.
I mean, that would explain the blood, but not enough to kill her.
So that left her bleeding and suffered a life-ending injury, and that theory.
You know, you brought up something that I'm curious about. You said that they found like a pint of blood and it was not enough. I wonder if there's a amount that if they come up to like, it's 2 quarts that they can consider it a murder scene. You know what I mean? Like murder happened here.
It makes sense.
No person could survive without that much blood.
I think there's got to be a threshold where they determine, okay, we're no longer dealing with like a small injury, but rather probably a death scene. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, they'd have to assume it, but I wonder if there's like a limit that says, you know.
It's got to be. So the last theory is that she had actually interrupted it at some point, probably when she came home from the dentist appointment. She had actually interrupted an intruder in her house, and he or she had attacked her, and she had suffered some sort of fatal attack. And again, that's possible. The neighbor's spottings of her are kind of weird.
Walking down the street and stuff.
In and out throughout the afternoon. Well,
see, the whole abortion one is what I was thinking all along because of the coat hanger and the amount of blood and everything, but it doesn't explain why she would disappear.
It doesn't, and I didn't explain it because you can't cover all scenarios in here, but her husband and her friends all say basically that they were trying to have a third kid. So if she was pregnant, theoretically, she would have been happy about it, not trying to abort. Now, that's according to who knows.
Well, I was thinking when you said it,
was feeling.
There was extra beer bottles or whatever. Like maybe she was having an affair.
And again, those things are possible. But just because her friends say she wanted to have another kid, that doesn't mean she really did.
Right. She may have just told them that for sure.
Troy, what do you think?
I'm going with the abortion. I don't know why she's walking around after an abortion back and forth, but.
Yeah, but I just wonder where she went.
This is hard to follow.
Well, no, they spotted her. Like, if you probably covered when a lot of people spotted an injured, distraught woman walking along the roads in Massachusetts. That's that same week or that same day.
The blood would be in certain areas that you could tell that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, for our last disappearance, we're going to stay right here in Maine. This was the largest investigation in the history of Maine. 20-month-old Ayla Reynolds was put to bed by her father, Justin DiPietro, on the night of December 16th, 2011. They were staying at Justin's mother's house on Violet Avenue in Waterville, Maine. Also in the house at the time were Justin's girlfriend, Courtney Roberts, and his sister, Phoebe DiPietro. Ayla had recently been placed in the home of her father by the Maine Department of Human Services, the DHS, and it's been reported that the DHS employee in this case did not conduct a home visit prior to the placement, as was common procedure. Ayla's mother, Trista Reynolds, lived in the area, but says she was on her way to rehab for heroin addiction at the time. Justin DiPietro called police on the morning of December 17th, and said that his daughter was no longer in her bed, and she was nowhere to be found. Police launched a massive investigation, but little of anything was turned up at first. Ayla was 2'9" tall, weighed 30 pounds, had beautiful blonde hair, and was last seen wearing green polka dot PJs with the words "Daddy's Princess" printed on the front. Both parents spoke with the press and went on network television. Mother Trista Reynolds didn't mince words on the Today Show when speaking about her daughter's father. "He's the only one that can answer my questions," she said. "You know, like, we have a daughter that is missing. We used to be able to get along all the time. He was the last one to see her alive." 6 weeks after she disappeared, police stated they had found blood in the basement of the home that she went missing from. There wasn't enough to make any charges, but the police statement was, "It's more blood than a small cut would produce." The blood was positively identified as of coming from Ayla. Her father tried telling police that someone had come into the house in the middle of the night and had taken her. Investigators did not believe him. The story does not pass the straight-faced test, Maine public safety spokesman Stephen McClausen said at the time. A $30,000 reward was offered for information that led to her safe return. The reward produced 1,200 leads, but none of them led to her discovery. 5 months into the investigation, police came to the conclusion that the little girl would not be found alive. News crews were on hand at the Reynolds home while the press conference was held, and her mother burst into tears and shouted, "He fucking knew! That man killed my baby!" In 2017, Ayla was declared legally dead. The death was ruled to have been likely on the night she disappeared. News crews went to interview the father's family, and none of them wished to speak. Justin himself fled to California. When a reporter with Crime Watch Daily tracked him down there and asked, quote, "Do you think it was someone that you knew or a stranger?" she asked. Someone I know, he replied. "Could we meet at another time?" A little shady.
The dad did this shit. I remember this case, and this sucks.
I mean, all he's trying to do is schedule another time.
Yeah, this one sucks. I'll let you finish, but this is...
Trista Reynolds filed a wrongful death suit against Justin. She later expanded it to include his mother and his sister. "I wonder if this is haunting you, Justin," she said during a press conference. "I wonder if our daughter haunts your dreams, or if you see her blue eyes when you close your eyes at night. I wonder if you even think about that night that you murdered her."
Yeah, mom doesn't mince any words on this
one. Nor should she.
And nor should she, because I'm sure she's right.
So COVID has caused delays in the court system as far as her court case, her civil case, and the case is yet to go to trial. Ayla's body has never been found, and neither her father nor anyone else has ever faced criminal charges in this case. Let's face it, that fucker did it.
Yeah.
We all know he did it.
Yeah, it's super shady, this one. I mean, he tried passing it off. Somebody came into the house, and there's no proof of that.
No, the Maine State Police don't believe that, and I don't believe that. And
I don't think anybody believes that.
No.
That one's tough. That's a tough case.
Yeah, when you're dealing with kids, that shit bugs me. I have trouble reading it. It gets me fucking worked up. I don't like it.
Yeah.
I don't like it. Fuck him.
Yeah, absolutely. Ended on a rough one there, but that was a great episode, Ryan. A lot of interesting cases.
Thanks, bud.
And so we are going to take it to the fire pit, but before we do, like we do every time, we're going to ask you guys to please send in your stories. Like we said, it can be a paranormal story, it can be a funny story, anything that you would talk to your friends about around the fire pit. Anything like it, send it to beyondtheshadows207@gmail.com or send it to any of our socials. It can be written,
recorded. We know you've got them. You've got gems.
You all do. You know who's sending them all? All of our overseas listeners. They share.
Yeah.
We like the UK, Australia.
UK and Australia. You guys
What's
have been
up,
sending
US,
them left and right. You
Canada.
Guys left and right.
We get them from Canada. We're not getting them from here in the States. You people need to get off your butts and send them in. Anyways, all right. We'll catch you in the fire pit.
you know what time it is. You're getting dragged to that fire pit.
All right, so this fire pit was brought to us by Amanda from the One Nothing podcast. It's an amazing podcast. They do a lot of different stuff. From
thank you, Amanda. We love you.
Yes, yeah, so from animal attacks to I just recently she did one about a tornado. I mean, it's a super interesting show. Her
she's
and Dave,
she's awesome.
Yeah, she is. Awesome. She does it with David from Down the Rabbit Hole, and they do a great job. So check them out. This is a story from her.
I did just recently see for the first time a haunted vehicle. Not a haunted, but a ghost vehicle, which I never believed in until recently. So I only believe in things that I've experiences with. So UFOs, yes. Apparitions, yes. But if you would have asked me before the last 2 weeks if I believed in ghost cars, my answer would have been no. But I'm pretty sure I had an experience with one not long ago. Was driving down the road, down the stretch of highway. It's about 50 miles an hour, and it's two lanes, and it's through a more rural part of the city. So there's not much, and it's a busy road. Like, that, I don't know what the word for it would be. Municipal, not a highway, but pretty close to it. So there's not any turnoffs or places to make U-turns, which is very commonplace down here. We were driving down the road. There was a guy beside me in a black car that was initially behind me, and he swung out into the right lane beside me to try to pass me. And being the egotistical jerk I am, I did not want to let him pass me, so I sped up. So I'm like, you're an asshole, and I'm already speeding. I was already going faster than the speed limit, so I found this to be rude. I know, I should have just let him pass me, but whatever. So I sped up even further, and we were kind of neck and neck, and I look in front of me, and I see that I'm quickly approaching and gaining speed on this car, and it's like a red, really, really dull, boxy sedan of some kind. Older, like 90s-ish, maybe early 2000s. But it's super, super dim, and my first thought was, this fucking guy's headlights aren't even on, his taillights aren't even on, and so I slow down, you know, lay on the brakes. The guy beside me also lays on his brakes. I don't know if he did that because he saw me slow down or because he also saw this car, but either way, he slowed down as well. We both go back down to closer to 50, which is the speed limit. The car in front of me is going really, really slow, so I slow down even further. And I get probably 3 or 4, maybe 5 car lengths away from it, enough to kind of see the taillights are like this rectangular shape on the side of the car. I have no idea what kind of car, but it looked boxy. Like, think like those Crown Vicks or like Van Marquis, how they were boxy like that. Looked like that. But it was red, super, super dim. Like, it didn't even really belong with the rest of what my eyes were seeing. Everything was kind of one focus, and then this car was just this really dim, fuzzy little thing. And I know that I saw it because I had a full thought process about the guy's brake lights being out and about how I was going to hit him. I slowed down really hard. Like, I know I saw him. I looked at it for several seconds. I saw the car. And then when I turned to observe the car beside me that was like trying to get in front of me, when he slowed down when I did, I turned and looked at him. Only briefly. My eyes just barely left. I looked over and looked at him. And when I looked back in front of me, that car was gone. Gone, gone, gone. And I immediately was looking for places it could have turned. Even if somehow I would have had the time to make a turn in that way, there was no turns. And that, to make sure, I went back a couple days later in the daytime and I drove the same stretch of road. There's nowhere to turn. There's nowhere to go. For at least a good 1.5-mile stretch of road, there's no turn-offs. There's no U-turns. There's no shoulders that you can be hidden easily by trees or anything like that. So that really freaked me out. I immediately messaged my bestie, David, and told him all about it. And then we talked about it a little bit on a recent Patreon episode. And he asked me some questions, and I was able to recall all of the details. So I'm very confident that that's what I saw. I am not typically one to believe that. I don't believe in Bigfoot. I don't believe, like I said, I wouldn't have even believed in ghost cars until this experience. But I can't say what else it could have been. I know that I saw it. I know it wasn't just a flash because I reacted to it and had a whole thought process about it while it was happening. So I don't doubt my mind in that aspect, but that was definitely creepy.
That's an interesting story. My only problem with is it where you said you don't believe in Bigfoot. What the fuck? Ghost cars are fine, but Bigfoot, not so much.
Always going to run those fuckers off the road.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I listening to that story, thank you, Amanda, for the story. It was a great story.
Awesome story.
It reminded me, I don't know, it reminded me of the movie. You remember the movie The Car?
Yeah, 1977 with James Berlin.
Yes.
I was thinking of The Wraith.
I watched it at your house.
It's It's better than.
Think of The Wraith, like the 80s movie with Charlie Sheen.
It's better than it sounds. It's better than it gets credit for.
Yeah, it's a like a demon car or whatever. Yeah, it just reminded me of that. But
it's a mid 80s movie called The Wraith with Charlie Sheen, which is similar. Demon car.
Demon car, yeah. So that's what it was, Amanda. You saw a demon car.
You saw Charlie Sheen.
Yeah. On Tiger Blood.
No, it wasn't Bigfoot.
Apparently, he's not real.
It was Charlie Sheen.
All right, Amanda, thank you for the story. Everybody, please send your stories in to beyondtheshadows207@gmail.com.
Thank you, Amanda, and everybody, check out the One Nothing podcast.
Yes, absolutely. Jump over there and check them out. And we will catch you in the next one.
Later, guys.